From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Once upon a time, says Thomas Frank, Kansas was a leftist dream. In the 1890s, Kansas embraced the populist movement fervently, electing populist mayors, governors, senators, and Supreme Court justices. In 1908, when socialist crusader Eugene V. Debs suffered a crushing defeat in his bid for the presidency, Kansas was home to one of the four counties he won. But today, 96 years later, Kansas is overwhelmingly Republican. In the language of political pundits, a rock-solid red state. And this, says Frank, is in spite of the fact that Republicans' economic policies consistently hurt the heartlanders who vote them into office. Tonight on Point, Thomas Frank on red state politics, culture wars, and his new book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. But first today, a military judge declared the Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad a crime scene that cannot be dismantled. In a May 24 speech at the Army War College, President Bush had offered to dismantle the facility to help remove the stain of torture from the new Iraq.
America will fund the construction of a modern maximum security prison. When that prison is completed, detainees at Abu Ghraib will be relocated. Then, with the approval of the Iraqi government, we will demolish the Abu Ghraib prison as a fitting symbol of Iraq's new beginning.
Retired Rear Admiral John Hudson is the former Judge Advocate General of the Navy and currently Dean and President of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in New Hampshire. I asked him to explain the legal significance of designating the prison a crime scene.
I think what it means is that he believes that there is a good chance that the court members, which is what we refer to the jury in military parlance, may want to actually go there in order to see precisely where the alleged crimes took place. And that would be not terribly typical. I think he's being very cautious in preserving what is potentially a crime scene, but it's probably a safe precaution, you know, a good thing to be doing.
So it's to give the jury some kind of idea of the atmosphere of the prison rather than preserving any kind of forensic evidence.
I would be very much surprised if it's actually preserving forensic evidence, but questions come up, for example, supervision and oversight, and that creates questions of, well, if this was taking place here in this corridor, you know, where was the supervisor located? What was the lines of sight and the communication and that sort of thing? Because that is clearly going to be a defense for some of these crimes. You know, the question of was it authorized, either tacitly or explicitly, that the prisoners be treated this way? That creates questions of who was where and what could they see and what could they overhear and that sort of thing.
Now, in another ruling, the military judge today also gave permission for defense lawyers to question Central Command Chief John Abizaid and Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. What's the thinking there?
Well, the thinking there is that the responsibility could go quite high. And, you know, the military is very hierarchical. Things go down the chain of command. And the question of who's responsible and were they following orders or carrying out orders becomes relevant, so that finding out precisely what was told to them by the superiors in the chain of command is important in putting together a potential defense.
So the military judge is establishing, is he, a chain of command here?
Well, he's certainly recognizing the chain of command and that this is likely not, or at least potentially not, going to end at, say, Brigadier General Karpinski, but may actually go above her to people much higher in the chain of command, and in fact, back here at Tampa, at Central Command.
Lawyers for the accused had also wanted to speak to President Bush and the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld. How did the judge rule there?
Well, that's not going to happen. And what will happen is that by making the request and having it denied, they will create an issue for appeal if there is a guilty verdict in the case. And that's always good for the defense. You know, the defense likes to have as many issues as they can appeal as they possibly can. And sometimes defense counsel will raise issues, hoping that it's denied because it may be better on appeal than if they'd actually had the motion granted. So he'd probably rather appeal the issue than actually have President Bush there.
I mean, also denied was a request to move the trial out of Iraq. The consequences of that?
That doesn't happen very often, actually, in any jurisdiction, but particularly in the military. Iraq is where most of the witnesses are. It's where the offenses took place. It is the logical place to hold the trial, and the military prides itself, justifiably, I would say, in the ability of its court members to disassociate themselves with the heat and the pressure and the emotion of notorious cases. So that would have been, it would have been very surprising to move the trial.
It does seem as if the defense teams are pulling out all the stops for their clients. How do you read their strategy?
Well, I'm a fan of military justice, and I will tell you that defense often pulls the stops out. These people are, the military counsel are being assigned the responsibility, the civilian counsel are being paid to do the very best job that they can. So it doesn't surprise me that they are raising every issue they can think of and mounting the very best, most professional defense that they can. That's the way the system works, and that's what makes the system work.
Where do you think the government might be most vulnerable?
I think in the question that you raised earlier, Julian, the question of the chain of command and to what extent the people, the accused, which is what we call defendants in the military, to what extent they were in fact or they believed that they were carrying out the direction of the people senior to them. Because if they were and they had, and it was a reasonable belief, then that may provide a defense to the charges.
John Hudson, many thanks.
You're more than welcome, Julian. Thank you.
And retired Rear Admiral John Hudson is former Judge Advocate General of the Navy. He's now Dean and President of the Franklin Pierce Law Center. He spoke to me from Concord, New Hampshire. In 1910, when Theodore Roosevelt wanted to deliver a speech skewering corruption in business on a gigantic scale and signal his shift to the left, he chose Kansas as the place to do it. But today, a century later, says author Thomas Frank, Kansas is a hotbed of conservatism. The state is no longer known for its lefty politics, for its school board's attack on the teaching of evolution in public schools, and for Fred Phelps, its gay-bashing right-wing preacher. But even though Kansans today consistently vote Republican, says Frank, very few of them ever benefit from Republican fiscal policy. The GOP conquered Kansas, says Frank, by preaching values, duping the Sunflower State into voting against its own financial self-interest. Tonight on Point, author and native Kansan Thomas Frank on Red America, conservative politics, and his new book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Do you agree with Frank that Kansans are voting against their own self-interest? Is right-wing cultural populism a con job acted out on a credulous red state Americans? Or is that condescending? Do conservative Kansans and Thomas Frank simply have different priorities on election day? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Thomas Frank, founding editor of the cultural criticism journal, The Baffler, and author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Thomas Frank, thanks very much for being with us.
How you doing, Julian?
I'm well, and thanks to you, of course, Jack Beattie.
Well, hello, Julian, and hello, Tom.
Thomas Frank, you're born and raised, part raised, in Kansas, and much of your critique of Kansas's right-wing shift stems from that. Just give us some sense of the differences you see between Kansas as you grew up and Kansas today.
Well, it's in my lifetime, it was always a Republican state, but the difference was that it was a moderate Republican state. You remember Bob Dole in '96? He sort of typified the Kansas Republicanism, and Nancy Kassebaum, who was the daughter of Alf Landon, she was even a fairly liberal Republican, And that was and there were some Democrats from the state. Wichita had a Democratic congressman, that kind of thing, when I was growing up. And, you know, I moved to Chicago, and I'll never forget how I picked up a newspaper in 1999 and read that the school board back in Kansas had decided it was time to take on Darwin again, and this astonished me. But I should take a step back here and say that although the book, I do a lot of research in Kansas for the book, and the word Kansas is the name of the state is even in the book's title. It's not strictly a book about Kansas. It's about the pop conservative mindset and the culture.
But in the book, I mean, so dramatic is this rightward shift that you see not only a change in the political but also geographic landscape of Kansas.
Absolutely. I mean, it's when you drive around in the countryside now, the industrialization of the farm country is dramatic. And the demise of the family farm. You go through the small farm towns, and this is, you know, last time I had really spent a lot of time driving around there was in the early 80s, and I came back to do the research for this book, and I was, I was horrified to see what had happened to these towns where every business on Main Street, or almost all of them, and doesn't matter which town you're in, it's the same bleak picture. The store's all boarded up, and all that's left is usually a thrift store. You drive, and even the cities in the state, like Wichita, which is a good sized manufacturing town, has for different reasons here, but the same phenomenon. It's in a terrible local recession. Lots of stores boarded up. Now, I should say that although this stuff is shocking to me and was disturbing, Kansas is by no means in the worst economic straits of anywhere in America. It's not even close to that. It's about in the middle of the pack. One of the reasons that I wanted to look that I'm so interested in it is because it's such an average sort of place.
I know that you feel very strongly about it, but there is a tone in the book of condescension, as if Kansans don't know their own minds.
Well, I wouldn't say that, and I would actually take issue with what you said in the introduction about people being duped. This is not an argument I would ever make, because and in fact, the only time there's this term that people in academia like to throw around, false consciousness. And not only would I never use that to describe what's going on,
but you use the word deranged, don't you?
Yeah, that's in a metaphorical passage. I'm trying to describe the derangement of the in our politics generally since the 1960s.
But it comes through very strongly that you feel that Kansans are voting for the wrong reasons. Yeah.
Oh, that's absolutely. There's no question about that. And I think this is something that that is very easy to document. That conservatism. I mean, I think the way to describe it is as a one of the ironies of American history, that conservatism has worked terrible disasters on these people and on people in lots of different communities around the country, and yet the people there persist in voting conservative. So the point is not that they were duped. The point of the book is to find out why they do this. And my conclusion isn't that they were tricked.
Jack Beattie, a very quick 30-second comment from you on Thomas Frank's thesis.
Well, you get points for asking the right question, and he's asking the question of American politics, how it is in the years when real incomes fell for most Americans and workers faced reduced pensions, medical benefits, the works, why for the first time since the Depression we've had downward mobility, why at the same time conservatism has flourished in the country. That's the question of questions of American politics today. And Tom gets points for asking it. I don't know about his answer, but it's the right question, and it's bristling with paradox. You can't just come at that simply. It isn't simply manipulation, but there's a kind of permissive exploitation in it too, worth talking about.
Jack Beattie, do stay with us, and you too, Thomas Frank. We're talking tonight about American conservatism, red state values, and how the Republicans won the heartland. Are you a Democrat who switched political allegiance, a newly converted member of the grand old party? On election day, what are you looking for, a candidate who shares your values or one who represents your financial interests? Both? Neither? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Kansas politics and the Sunflower State's long drift to the right. Our guest, Thomas Frank, says it's the ultimate conservative success story. And as goes Kansas, so goes the nation. He writes that, and I quote, "Kansas is ready to lead us singing into the apocalypse. It invites us all to join in, to lay down our lives so that others might cash out at the top, to renounce forever our middle American prosperity in pursuit of a crimson fantasy of middle American righteousness." A dramatic prediction. Do you agree? Are Kansas politics a harbinger for the country? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Still with me, Thomas Frank. Is that another of your purple passages, or do you really feel that with a passion?
That as Kansas goes, so goes the nation?
Indeed.
I wouldn't want to make that prediction, but that this is the way that the whole country is going to go, because that's not the kind of writer that I am. I don't do predictions, but it is one of the things that Kansans are always very proud of. And if you read any histories of the state, they'll always tell you how we had the Civil War here before the rest of the country, and we had invented Pizza Hut and this sort of thing. And things do tend to come out of Kansas. It's curious, and it is, as I said earlier, it is this sort of perfect microcosm of America.
But could I just nail you on that specific point? I mean, is it possible that conservative Kansans actually agree with the Republican Party's cultural values and its free market values? Are they necessarily voting against their own economic self-interest?
Well, they are, technically speaking, they are voting against their economic – when they vote for these very conservative candidates, that is what they're doing. But whether or not they they can certainly still agree with the person. And this is a phenomenon that I actually found several people – What you ordinarily find is that the economics issues aren't discussed. That's not what the debate is about, and the debate is about the cultural issues, and the debate is about the changing values in the country and the big picture stuff. I mean, the politicians there will make very grandiose claims that politics are about a struggle for the national soul. And going a few steps down the register. To an issue like abortion, where it's an issue that mobilizes millions of people on the most fundamental grounds. And so these things tend to – it's not so much that they overshadow the economic issues. It's that the economic issues just aren't raised.
Okay, let's take a call from Kansas City itself. Jackie's on the line. Jackie, you are a Democrat, but what's your question for Thomas Frank?
I found it. He's pretty on point about the state of Kansas. I live in the most Democratic county in Kansas, which is Wyandotte County. But as you drive further to the south in the state, like Wichita, you start seeing these signs that say, it's a child, not a choice. And I have a friend who works in Wichita during the week, and he's a Democrat, liberal Democrat, and he goes, "I can't watch TV down here. It's like God TV."
But what accounts, though, for your county being a Democrat oasis or bolt hole, whichever way you look at it?
Probably because we're next to the county that Mr. Frank grew up in.
Johnson County, yeah. And you're just annoyed with Johnson County? Or, I mean, you've got to put this in your own words.
With Johnson County.
I know, I'm annoyed with it.
And Jackie, are you a lifelong Democrat?
Yes, I am. And the interesting thing, my father is close to 80, and I find he gets more liberal the older he gets. And the interesting thing is, if you look at our governor race a few years ago, they went for Kathleen Sebelius over Tim Schallenberger, a very conservative Republican.
Yeah, how do you account for that? Thomas Frank.
Well, that was an interesting case. The Kansas Republicans outnumbered Democrats by a pretty wide margin in terms of voter registrations in Kansas. And I should point out, by the way, that the caller comes from one of my favorite counties in America, Wyandotte County, Kansas, with the home of some of the finest barbecue in the nation. And we won't talk about that now. But in the governor's race 2 years ago, what you'll often see happening in Kansas is that the main fights are within the Republican Party, and you've got two big factions there: the moderate Republicans, who tend to be pro-choice, and also tend to come from the state's business class, from its professional class. And then you have the conservative Republicans. And this is what astonished me, that the conservative Republicans tend to come from the more working class areas, with Wyandotte County, where the caller is from, being the sort of signal exception to the rule here. And so these two factions, though, they fight it out, and they really don't get along. I mean, they dislike one another much worse than they dislike the Democrats. And so and this happens in a number of races there, where one side will win the nomination, the Republican nomination, over the other faction, and then the faction that has lost the nomination will then bolt for the Democrat. And this is what happened. And with the conservative candidate won the Republican nomination, and the moderates found him so intolerable that they went for the Democrat, or a lot of them did anyway.
Jack Biedig, do you agree with that analysis of that political anomaly in Kansas?
It sounds right. I mean, my feet have never had the privilege of walking on Kansas soil, and I look forward to that someday. It'll improve my education. But you know, when you think about the two parties in Kansas, I mean, and Tom does get into this some. It's hard to say that the people voting for the Republican Party are all that wrong. I mean, you know, neither party represents their interests, so they vote for the party that better represents their values, and that is the GOP.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. And it delivers. I mean, you know, gag rule on abortion internationally, stem cell research, abstinence-only programs in the schools, an effort to appoint anti-choice judges. It delivers, or tries to deliver, on the values agenda. Whereas the Democrats, I mean, look at Clinton. He gave the Midwest NAFTA, the China health deal. They didn't get health care. Dick Gephardt tells a story of he used to carry around a rubber home plate from a town in South Dakota that was just emptied out. And that was the home plate from the school playing field. The town was no more because NAFTA had wrecked the sugar beet industry, and that was done by a Democratic president. So it's hard to turn around to the people who've lost their livelihoods and say, you know, vote for us. We're the party what'll we do? Well, we'll expose you to international competition real fast. That's what we'll do. Whereas the Republicans, they're going to do the same thing, but at least they're going to, make noises on the culture war.
So Thomas Frick, Jack Biedig there, suggesting that the Democrats have a role to play, or can be blamed in part anyway for the rise of this conservative Republicanism in Kansas. But can I just get back? You don't like the use of the word dupe, but has there been a manipulation, do you think, by these conservative Republicans in Kansas of cultural values, of natural sentiments?
Well, there's sort of your run of the mill, the kind of manipulation that's standard in politics. And by the way, I should say that what Jack was saying about the Democrats is that's precisely the argument that I make in the book, that the Democrats have made this choice real easy for blue collar voters in a lot of places by basically selling them out on the economic issues. And NAFTA in particular was a very big deal with blue-collar voters in Kansas. And when Clinton signed on to the Republican economic agenda, they said, look, there's no longer any difference between the two parties on these issues, these bread-and-butter issues that matter to us, so we might as well vote our conscience on the cultural issues. That's precisely what happened. And I think that's why Clinton's move to the right, you know, his triangulation was a real world-class blunder. But now then, as for the question of manipulation, what you find there, and I mean the only kind of manipulation that – I mean there's your sort of run-of-the-mill thing where you have something like Fox News where, you know, they – obviously the TV shows are calculated to wind you up and, you know, make you angry, and it's manipulative in that sense. But what you also find is our politicians who go from being members of one faction to being members of the other because that's more well, it always goes in one direction. They go from being members of the moderate Republican faction, which is the traditional sort of the traditional rulers of the state of Kansas, to being members of the conservative faction because that's who gets out the votes on Election Day.
Let's take a call from Matt in New York City. Matt, you've lived in Kansas, but you've got your own theory as to why working class people there should vote Republican. What is it?
Well, basically, I mean, I lived in New York my entire life. I grew up in New York City, and as crazy as it sounds, I ended up spending 3 years, my first 3 years out of New York City, at Washburn Law School, which is in Topeka, Kansas, the heart of conservatism. And I was actually at a law school where the students were more conservative than the staff. And I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked to see how so many people associated themselves with Republican ideals when Democratic ideals, you know, basically ideas pushed forward by the Democratic Party, would have been so much more in their interests.
But you use the word shocked. That's a very strong word.
Shocked. Shocked is the right word.
Well, why?
Well, I mean, you have to keep in mind, I had never even left, you know, the five boroughs of New York City. And I didn't know that there were really people out there that had cowboy hats and belt buckles and boots. I'd never seen that. When I got there, one of the first things I did was buy a gun because, you know, I didn't know it was legal, you know, and I find out my first week in law school that you can buy a gun in Kansas. And I thought that was great. So, you know, that's one thing I like about Republicans. You know, they're totally into guns. And for me, it was just about playing with it. But, you know, it was a great experience.
By the way, I should, if I can interject something here, I was a very good friend of mine in the state is a guy that's pretty far to the left, about as far as to the left as you can go, and he's a member of the NRA also. So.
Thomas Frank, you recently traveled through Kansas to promote this book. How was it received?
It's curious. The local press is very hostile. You might even say extremely hostile. And I sort of expected that would be the case. But at each of the – I did four events in Wichita, Topeka, Lawrence, and in Kansas City. And each of them had really large audiences. And I've never – you know, I've been writing books for years, sort of, cultural criticism kind of stuff. And I've never had this happen before. It was extraordinary. And the kind of – when I was in Wichita, there were three tornadoes while I was speaking. But there was the audience in each of these places, it was not only large, it was they were very affirmative. They were really supportive of the argument, and they all had anecdotes that they, you know, that they wanted to tell, and stories about friends of theirs and how, you know, that went down the same trajectory I've been describing. And, you know, they all wanted to talk about what they could do about it. We had it was great. And sometimes it's very tragic. In Wichita, there were a number of unemployed Boeing workers. Wichita's a big industrial town. I mean, it's suffering some really hard times right now. And there was, I've never had, unemployed industrial workers at a book reading before, much less buying the book. It was extraordinary. It was very, it really made me happy.
Is your
also,
book,
I love the food there.
Is your book as much as anything some sort of attempt, a riposte, if you like, at the neocon ideologues?
Yeah, but it definitely is. The neocons in some ways were the first ones that made this big move from the left to the right. I'm thinking of guys like Pedoritz and Irving Kristol back in the late 1960s. And this was an attempt to understand that entire culture of the right, the way that the right has captured issues of social class, has captured the kind of the old vocabulary of the left. And you'll remember that back in the late 60s when the neoconservatives changed sides, that was one of the things that they deliberately did, was bring the language of social class over to the conservative side and over to the Republican fold.
So they've redefined class.
Yeah, they have, as a matter of fact, and that's a point that I keep bumping into in the book, is that the way Republicans and conservatives generally talk about social class, they generally don't mean the place that you work, the kind of job that you do, the way that the sociologists mean it. What they mean by class is authenticity. They mean humility, being a middle American, driving a domestic car rather than a Volvo, drinking, I don't know, Maxwell House rather than lattes. And this is something that you see all the time in the, you know, the kind of, you know, the pop sociology literature in Washington, D.C.
And Jack Beattie, is this a debasing aspect, do you think, of the American political debate?
The sloganeering and the
sloganeering and this reclassification of the voters.
Well, there's a lot of that, and they slice it up fine. But you know, the answer on the other side to a mass movement, which conservatism is the labor movement. And it is a striking fact of commentary that the liberal intelligentsia in America has nothing but contempt for the main focus, the main energy of liberalism in this country, organized labor. It was said of Henry James that he was a whole generation removed from the odors of the shop. Well, the same thing could be said for Thomas Friedman and David Brooks and who knows how many other enlightened columnists who just have no conception of the politics of interests. In a strange way, liberals are for a politics of values, too. They call them rights, but they feel about them the same way that conservatives do about values. What they're not for is the politics of interests, that is, as represented by labor, higher wages, managed trade. That sort of thing is anathema to the liberal intelligentsia in this country, and therefore it cuts off liberalism from any of its vital sources.
That's the argument of my book. That was very eloquently summarized. I'm in complete agreement. You should have written this book.
Thomas Frank, any thoughts, though, on beyond blaming the Democratic Party in part for this shift, on what it needs to do to win back the working classes?
Absolutely. They have to start. They have to rediscover the language of economic populism. They have to start talking that old Rooseveltian language. And look, I don't want to be too optimistic about this. I mean, and we can go into the details of why this might work and might not work. But there's no question in my mind but that you have to somehow contest the ground of populism, the language of populism. Republicans are out there talking about the liberal elite all the time, and they've really captured the old terrain, the old cultural terrain of populism. And if Democrats have to at least contest it, they have to bring back something of the real thing. And I think if they did that in a really concerted manner, that this kind of fake populism of the right would just shatter. But as Jack Beattie would immediately point out, this means embracing the labor movement, and this means getting back to their blue collar roots. And that's not something that today's Democrats are very interested in doing. I mean, there's no money in it.
Okay, Thomas Frank, we'll develop that theme in a little while. Stay with us, and you too, Jack Beattie. We're talking tonight with author Thomas Frank about Heartland Politics and his new book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Do you agree with Frank that Democrats have lost the battle for middle America? If so, whose interest does today's Democratic Party represent? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking to Thomas Frank about politics in Red America. Which party do you see representing your interests and why? Frank writes that today's Republicans are, and I quote, the party of anti-intellectualism, of rough frontier contempt for sophisticated ideas and panty-waist book learning. Do you agree? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go straight to Tim, calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tim, as I understand it, you're an independent who's been leaning towards the Republican Party. Why?
Well, first of all, I'm leaning because I really do believe that the values of the Republican Party more closely aligned with mine. And I've not always been that way, but it seems that it's difficult these days to just be 100%. There's so many issues, and I don't know who started it, if it was Bush 1 or Clinton, but it just seems that if I have 10 issues that I believe One party's got six of them and the other one's got four of them. And then it just comes down to prioritizing for me. And I personally have just found myself seeing the Democratic Party being polarized or two major issues. And there seems to be so many liberals that if the one issue is abortion, it doesn't matter if the other nine issues are, if they're in favor with the Republicans, they're going to go with abortion. And it seems like the Republicans aren't quite that bad. I was watching a report that regarding U.S. senators, that there are several Republican senators that are pro-choice, but there is zero Democrats in the Senate and maybe one in the entire House.
Okay,
I'm
Tim.
Like, it just seems that I'm site. If there's 10 issues, I'm 60% Republican, but the issues that are big to me, I just seem to be more Republican. And your commentator's points about they're voting against their economic best interest. Well, there's more to of concern to me than, you know, who's going to give me a tax break or who's going to build a factory in my town. I've got a lot of other interests that are important to me.
Okay, Tim, let's just put that to Thomas Frank. And Tim, there, Thomas Frank was talking about there is a lot more that is important to him in life than simply economic self-interest. And in a way, that's what your book is predicated upon. You find it extraordinary
right.
that anybody should vote for anybody that doesn't actually further their economic self-interest.
Well, it's not that extraordinary. I mean, it's so commonplace that it would be hard to say. I mean, that's what everybody that I talk to in the book feels the same way. But one of the problems is as I see it anyway, is that the economic choices that the caller was describing are indeed so minor and so so unimportant that there's no way that could possibly outweigh something that an issue that makes claims as momentous as the pro-life people make for the abortion issue. You know, they say it's, you know, it's murder, for God's sakes. You know, it's this is something that would, you know, obviously outweigh something. You know, if you sincerely believe that, it's going to obviously outweigh, what were the economic examples he was giving, like a tax cut or something like that. But look,
so you're saying that it's the emotive language that the conservative Republicans frame their argument.
Yeah. That's part of it. But the issue I was leading up to is the bigger economic picture. And this is what we have to consider. And again, it's something that is not being debated by the two parties and it's not on the table. And so it's funny that I would even bring it up, right? But then again, I'm not, you know, I don't have anything to do with the two parties. But the questions that we ought to be debating are where the economy is going in a very, very large sense, right? What about inequality? What about the fact that in the 1990s, all these years of productivity advances and, you know, extraordinary economic developments basically only enriched shareholders and wages didn't go up very much at all. And what about what free market capitalism, the kind of ruin that it's enacting out on the Great Plains and in cities all across the country, you know, in Rockford, Illinois or Dayton, Ohio or anywhere that you go? Why aren't these questions on the table? Why aren't these the things that we're debating? It seems to me that that you would have a stark difference between the parties then, and you would have issues that would outweigh any conceivable kind of values questions.
Let's take a call from Paul in Woburn, Massachusetts. And Paul, you think Thomas Frank is condescending?
Yes, I do. I think the idea that people who vote Republican or have conservative social ideals are nothing but cavemen and yahoos, I do find condescending, yeah. And people have already mentioned the abortion issue, and that's one. I mean, if you even advocate restrictions on abortion, which even the majority of people in the United States would favor, there's no room for you in the Democratic Party. You won't be allowed to speak at a convention to advocate the idea that the state should decide when and under what circumstances abortion should be allowed, so the people's sense of morality should have a voice. It's judges now are determining whether or not it's discriminatory for homosexuals to be married or not. It's not the legislatures. And if you come out against that, are you allowed to speak at the Democratic convention? Of course not. It's the whole social agenda. It seems to me that it's not economic issues that are important to the Democratic Party. That is people at the top. It's social issues. They don't care about the people at the bottom. They care about, they have a vision of, a cultural vision of America in the future.
Okay.
And
okay.
For them, that is the most important thing. Second, if I make
okay.
the
bottom well, of could I just chip in there? And I just want to have a quick word from Jack Beattie before I come back to you, Thomas Frank. Jack, can you actually see the Democratic Party ever again becoming a sufficiently broad church, if that's the right metaphor, to encompass the moralities of upper-class liberals and working-class middle Americans?
In a word, no. I mean, it is under the control of its lobbies, its interests, and the abortion rights movement is very powerful there. And Tim and Matt are absolutely right. It is an orthodoxy in the Democratic Party. Robert Casey, the governor of Pennsylvania, couldn't speak to the convention a few years ago because he was against choice. He would have been hooted down, and yet the Democrats made great sport of Republicans for turning their backs when a gay man addressed their convention. Well, I mean, it's the same sort of, it's a different kind of orthodoxy, but orthodoxy just the same. So I do think that that issue of abortion has really cross-pressured a lot of people who might otherwise at least give the Democrats a thought.
And the final word to Thomas Frank, very, very briefly, can you see the Democrats ever recapturing the moral high ground?
Not in the current way that the party is set up, and not given the people that give money and the people who have power within the party. But I want to point out that while it's funny because I agreed with the last caller's description of the Democratic Party, but the idea that I'm condescending towards conservatives, this is the entire point of the book, is that I'm not. That liberals in the past have been like that, and they indeed are condescending. And the whole idea of the book is that I'm going out there and talking to these people and trying to understand what they're, what they're about, which liberals never, ever do. They just brush it off.
Thomas.
But, all right, that's all.
It's very good to have had you with us.
Well, thank you for
Thomas
having
Frank.
Me. Wonderful.
Founding editor of the Cultural Criticism Journal, the BAFTA, and author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. I was also speaking to our very own on-point news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, making the case for keeping Alexander Hamilton on the $10 bill. This is On Point. A recent ABC News poll has bad news for those who want Ronald Reagan's face to grace the $10 bill. Only 36% of those polled would like to see Reagan replace Alexander Hamilton on the sawbuck, and only 31% want him to bump FDR off the dime. Still, the effort to memorialize the nation's 40th president on currency has plenty of momentum. Among the supporters is influential Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell. Ron Chernow is the author of the recent biography, Alexander Hamilton. He's dismayed by the talk of Hamilton's visage getting booted from the $10 bill. In this radio diary, Ron Chernow makes the case for keeping Hamilton on the 10.
Hamilton has been overlooked over the past two centuries, but I would maintain that with the clear exception of George Washington, that nobody did more to weld the squabbling 13 states into the powerful nation that we know today than Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary, but that really does not convey the magnitude and scope of his power, because in Washington's cabinet, there were only three departments, State, War, and Treasury. And the Treasury Department was many times larger than the rest of the government combined, which is why when historians talk about this period, they tend to liken Hamilton's role in the early republic to that of a prime minister under George Washington rather than a mere department head. So to say he was the first Treasury Secretary doesn't quite capture the scope of his powers and achievement. And Hamilton, as the first Treasury Secretary, really forges the basic building blocks of the federal government. He creates the first tax system, the first budget system, the first Coast Guard, the first Customs Service, the first central bank. Alexander Hamilton takes a country that was literally bankrupted by Revolutionary War debt and restores American public credit. All the while, Hamilton, who was not only a great administrator and technocrat, but a great lawyer and constitutional scholar, is making the enduring constitutional arguments that these activities are, in fact, permissible. So that I would say that if George Washington was the father of the country, if James Madison was the father of the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton was really the father of the federal government. I think that Alexander Hamilton has been forgotten relative to the other founding fathers because for a long time, his great rival in the early republic, Thomas Jefferson, seemed to triumph. But I think that in retrospect, it is Hamilton in many ways who was much more prescient about the future than Jefferson. Jefferson and Hamilton embodied two different visions of America's future. Thomas Jefferson foresaw a nation of independent yeoman farmers with a weak central government. He stressed states' rights and a strict construction of the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton foresaw a bustling, diversified economy, not only with traditional agriculture, but with banks, stock exchanges, corporations, factories, a country that, in fact, very much resembles the one that we have today. Even though Hamilton, to my mind, belongs in the first rank of founding fathers, when we go to Washington, Thomas Jefferson has his temple on the Potomac. George Washington has his soaring monument on the Mall. And Alexander Hamilton, whose contributions were certainly equal to theirs, has a very small statue tucked away behind the Treasury Building in a spot where probably not one tourist in 10,000 sees it. And while millions of visitors have made the pilgrimage to Monticello, Hamilton has been treated very shabbily by posterity. His house, the Grange, which he occupied in his final years, is in Harlem. It's squashed between a six-story apartment building and a brick church, squashed into such a tiny space that they actually had to move the front porch around to the side of the house to fit it in order to preserve it. And I find it sad and very frustrating that now that Hamilton, with the approach of the 200th anniversary of his death on July 12th, 2004, now that Hamilton is finally getting his due, that there is an effort to remove him from the $10 bill, which has been really his only memorial because the country has not given him proper credit. And so while I don't in any way mean to detract from the achievement of President Reagan, I think that we have accorded special status on our bills and coins to people who had a special place either in forging the country during the Revolutionary era or preserving it during the Civil War. And Hamilton himself felt that the currency was a place where we should instill civic virtue, we should be taught to venerate our greatest leaders, and I think that it sends the right message to have George Washington on the $1 bill, Abraham Lincoln on the $5 bill, and Alexander Hamilton on the $10 bill.
Ron Chernow is the author of the biography Alexander Hamilton. He lives in New York City. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.